What we're talking about is late night and early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers into the afternoon. With variable high cloudiness and gusty winds. Gusty winds at times around that corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold blooded. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health. And the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerting, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Colder than the ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition.
Yeah.
There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a lone gust wind in the bedroom.
And ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection. Daryl Bradford Smith is my name, and it's great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is a remarkable day to be fighting the bad guys, because, you know, this eighth day of November, it's hotting up out there, guys. We're starting to really peel back the masks of these criminals. Jack Abramoff, this man was courting Mr. Atta, and he was giving him free trips on his gambling casino boat and his other access to some of his other prestigious enjoyment places and palaces and stuff. And Mr. Abramoff, ladies and gentlemen, was a Mossad, get it, Israeli Mossad plant. Yes, he was. We know that. We know that the bin Laden family works with the Mossad. We know that because all the investigations we've been able to look into through Herzliya and the rest of it have all pointed to that. We know that the Israelis were the ones who organized, principal organizers of 9/11. We know that. Yep. We know the company that provided security for the airport which Atta left from is an Israeli company owned by Mossad principals. In other words, the two sons of the founder of the Mossad own the security company that offers the security for Logan Airport in Boston. Hey, Boston, did you know that? All kinds of stuff, guys. It's all coming out. Tom DeLay, biggest supporter of Mr. Abramoff. Big money coming from them. Who is Abramoff? He is APEC. He is the Jewish lobby. He is the, but see, we have to qualify this, and I say it every time. It's not all the Jews, ladies and gentlemen. Less than 1 in 10 of them are supporters of Zionism. So that means 90% of the Jews in the United States have nothing to do with this. So be very careful. We're talking about an elite group of Zionist criminals, a mafia the likes of which the world has never known. And those are the people that we are doing battle with. We're fighting them, and we're fighting to expose them. And this show is doing just that. You know, today we're going to talk about Martin King's murder. Martin King was murdered in 1968 on the orders of our then FBI chief under a little-known 1946 law that we're going to talk about with my guest. His name is Kidi Awadu. He's done the research. He's got the smoking guns. He's going to talk about them. And what you're going to find out is the person who benefited from it all and was an insider in the arrangement of these murders is alleged to be none other than Jesse Jackson. Reverend Sham. Yeah, and we've got all kinds of, we've got him in several contradictory statements, lies, if you want to call them what they really are. And he's a bad guy. And, you know, one of the things you need to understand about our government for some time now is you don't rise up in its ranks, any type of leadership, or you don't become a spokesman or an agent of the U.S. government unless you are compromised or a part of the criminal conspiracy. That's just the way it works. So Jesse Jackson fits that model perfectly, and he was, you know, given all kinds of access after Martin King's death. And the King family has earlier on raised questions about it. They have since backed off from those, probably under pressure or threat, maybe under gift giving from the powers that be. But in every instance, ladies and gentlemen, the powers that be are still Israeli Zionists and elites, MI6 agents, as well as parts of our government. You know, I got to tell you something. We are a phenomenon, the French Connection. We are a phenomenon. I spoke today to 60 million people in Africa, ladies and gentlemen, on a radio show. Generally, their audience is 100 million, and they're one of the largest radio shows in the world. Most people in Africa don't own televisions yet. They still all basically listen to radio. And I went on the CII network and spoke about some things about that are happening in the rioting here in France. But they also mentioned, you know, some of the other research that I've been doing. We are becoming a phenomenon because it's pretty obvious. I don't have an agenda here except to tell on these people. That's it. You know, it's straightforward. No fluff. No P.T. Barnum. It's facts as I can find them. Sometimes I don't have them all lined up. Sometimes I don't get them all raised up in a row. But you know, I do have enough of it that it rings true. And then I get other people emailing me afterwards, and other people that I have a contact with that fill in some of my blank spots for me or help me to suss out the truth. There are some people out there, many people out there, trying to push a absolutely fraudulent and ridiculous, foolish, stupid, beyond measure, moronic, imbecilic, bug-eyed, moronic thing called the hologram theory of the 9/11 attack, the 9/11 destruction, the 9/11. Mass murder. It's hooey. It's a lie. It's bull. It's crud. It's crikey. And I had a guy named Dave. He happens to be a Jewish fella. I'm certain he's a Zionist, who's been spreading all over the internet that you know, I'm lying and then this and that and everything. Well, you do the weight. You do the smell test here, ladies and gentlemen. If you asked 1,000 people if they thought a hologram was responsible for crashing into those buildings, you wouldn't get a single one out of 1,000 who said that was the truth. Yet, they pushed so hard at shoving this down the throat of the different 9/11 movements and people. And I had this guy actually cussing me out in emails. You know, they're going to be posted in my site soon, all of the emails that he sent me and all of the malarkey that he sent me. And he's saying that I'm disinformation. I'm a liar. He's saying he'll give me $500 if I prove that a hologram didn't hit the World Trade Center. Yeah, well, you know, I can't prove that pigs can't fly either. Maybe in some parallel universe out in the middle of Goobyville or something, they can do that. But in the real world, ladies and gentlemen, pigs don't fly and holograms don't crash into buildings. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the news, and we're going to get ready for our interview on the Martin Luther King murder when we come back, ladies and gentlemen. Wailing sounds of the harmonica. Great to be with you today, coming live and direct from central France. You know, we're still fighting over here to restore order to the streets of this nation, and all kinds of stuff happening over here. A lot of disenfranchised youth angry at their plight, 60% unemployment, problems of that nature. This is not a new issue here. Many of you will probably believe that this is all to do with Islam. It has nothing to do with Islam. The young people in these high-rise ghettos, as it were, are not in any way acting out of a religious belief. They are basically acting out of a trapped feeling of poverty. Not necessarily this present French government's fault. Not that I'm supporting all of the decisions they've made, but the way this has happened is that, first of all, globalization has destroyed the blue-collar workforce, just as it has in America. And, you know, the only jobs there are available here, of course, are McDonald-type jobs, and that's not, there's not enough of them to go around for these kids. And they certainly haven't worked hard enough in school to get engineering jobs, so they're unemployed, and they're going to be unemployed. There is just not going to be something for them to go to work at, doing. So how do you handle a problem like that? Well, one way might be to stop sending your jobs to Eastern Europe and to China, and holding on to the jobs for your own citizens. But see, that's not the goal of the controllers. The controllers want, you know, what, 50 cents an hour worker, and they don't want to pay somebody a living wage in their home country. So unless someone addresses that issue, these problems are just going to fester. It's just going to be a festering boil. And the other thing is that the culture is very different than the French culture of this many of these people. They have 6 and 7 children, and that's part of the North African culture. And when you have that kind of mentality going into a family structure and no jobs on the on the other side, you have nightmare scenarios, and that's exactly what we're experiencing over here. So this news cycle is getting it's hotting up, ladies and gentlemen. And you know, there's pictures on what really happened. I got to tell you all, you should go to this site, What Really Happened. It is incredible. News site, the best news site, period, on earth. It is rising as others are falling. I look at that Alexa web Alexa web search thing, and boy, Mike Rivero, my hat's off to you, my friend. You've done some remarkable work there. All kinds of interesting stuff being pasted up here. We've got this video about America using chemical weapons on the Fallujah assault. There were reports of this many, many months ago. In fact, I reported this on my show 7 months ago from a gentleman named Imad Kaduri. Imad told me that they were using chemical weapons in Fallujah, and it was reported on this show 6 months ago. There you go. That'll tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, about the people I speak to. You know, they're going out on limbs too. They're out there risking themselves and putting out the truth. Of course, I don't have the wherewithal or the finances or the structure over here to go to Iraq and confirm any of these things for myself. So it makes it a little difficult for me to do that. But I rely on honest, hardworking people who are interested in defeating tyranny that is rising in the world, and it's coming quickly. This control grid that needs to be in place before they can do their crackdown is quickly being in place, put in place here in Europe as well, and they're going to take advantage, as you would imagine they will, on these riots. Some people believe that these riots are actually done by agent provocateurs. I can't see that there's any evidence of that. I just think it's just something that has happened and was inevitable at some point. They've been burning cars in the French banlieues for a long time, which is the outskirts of the cities. They've been doing it for years. I mean, next to my father-in-law's house, they're burning cars every weekend. There's several of them on fire. In fact, last time I visited him, the explosion of the gas tank next door blew up and woke me up from my nap. So this is nothing new here in these areas. So, but the fact is, it's actually a lot of copycat stuff happening, and we can see it spreading into Belgium and Germany too, because they've got a lot of disaffected youth as well. You know, globalization has created a mess for everybody, and in fact, it has reduced quality, destroyed working class people. But by quality, what do I mean? Many of the products the Germans, the French, the Italians, and the Americans used to make were classic quality goods. Today, they have been streamlined and you get a single quality Chinese. That's it. You don't get a choice anymore. It's Walmart or the highway for you. And we've got our own Walmarts over here called Metro and Carrefour and the rest of it. And they sell, you know, plastic junk. And if you want anything of really high quality, and now it's so ridiculously priced you can't even afford it because basically they're not mass produced and are not quality designed, and they're junk. That's Chinese junk or nothing. So I we have to change course, ladies and gentlemen. I really think we have to go back 50 years in what we've done. The madness and the disenfranchisement and all the problems created. And we got to begin to start talking about how to, you know, rein in our human family. Now, I'm not talking about the way that the government's talking. I'm talking about we need to start saying to people, such as North African families that are still interested in 7 children, that is not a rational choice for a modern world. You can't raise 7 kids and a husband and wife in a 2-bedroom apartment in a high-rise building. It's fraught with disaster all over it. So part of it's education, and part of it's opportunity. But we just have to approach these things with dialogue, with rational thinking, with honesty, and not with genocide and viruses and poisoned water and, false wars and taking our kids off to places to get them killed. And this is not what we need. Of course, it's not what we need, ladies and gentlemen, but it's what we're getting. Again, you know, the whole situation that is transpiring in both in Europe and America right now is a setup for whatever they've got coming next, and that could be put into practice or place quite soon. I must say, there's no way of knowing when they're going to pull this next situation, but it could be any time now. You know, I work every day like you do at Truth. And I need the assistance of each and every one of you out there to tell your friends and family members and anybody who listen that this radio broadcast is actually growing exponentially, and we are going to punch these folks way beyond our weight class, ladies and gentlemen. You know, we are the pit bulls out here, and we're Eric Huffschmidt, myself, and many of my collaborators, and there is a whole host of them. If you go to IamTheWitness.com, you'll see that we're not doing this alone. We've got Karen Kwiatkowski, and we've got Michelle Shostakovsky, and we've got Felicity Arbuthnot, and I mean, there's a powerful list of hardworking people out there working for us. So they all need help. They all need support, and they all need your thanks. Get on the horn. Tell your friends to pick up this show somehow. Tell your local broadcaster to put it on. IamTheWitness.com is the website. Be right back. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We are back with a vengeance. Daryl Bradford Smith, your host today from Central France. IamTheWitness.com. You got to get to the website, ladies and gentlemen. It's off the hook. Before I go to my guest, I got a call from Arizona. Mike, are you with me? Michael.
Yes. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. Thanks. You had mentioned a story about Jack Abramoff and
yes.
Logan Airport and Mossad connections earlier,
yep.
And I was just trying to track that down.
Yep. Well, okay. There's a company that does the security for Logan. It's an Israeli company, in fact. The two principal establishers of the company were the children of the original founder of the Mossad. And in fact, they have parts of their organization were involved in the London security situation on 7/7, and they have contracts all over the world. Stuppel Airport in Holland is their contract. They've got Germany, I think Frankfurt Rhein Main is part of their contract, and basically they use it to funnel military things and all kinds of stuff all around the world. So if you take a look at this company, you will find that there's reasons to get the hackles on the back of your neck up. I don't have all of the details of the company, but if you look into it, Michael, you're going to be shocked.
Okay, did you find this as a story, or is this
No, well, actually, Christopher Bolin has done some research on it. It is actually circulated quite widely, except that most of these subjects never get any airplay, Mike. We're one of the only places that you can hear this. You know that. That's why you probably listen to the show.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. He probably wrote it up in the American Free Press, I would suspect.
Well, a lot of his stuff doesn't get vetted on that either.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, one of the things is that I'll tell you what. I'll ask my webmaster, Eric Huffschmidt, to dig up that information, and he'll put it on my website before the end of business today.
Yeah, great. You've got a very good website, and I know you keep encouraging people to go there, but I was just checking it out myself, and it's very well organized and a lot of good information there.
Well, thanks, Michael.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate you very much, and all my listeners. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, I don't usually take very many calls, but it's great to hear that people appreciate my work. My guest today, what can I say about this? This is, you know, I instantly like this guy. I mean, instantly. I think it was mutual. You can tell when somebody's onto a hot truth, and you can tell when somebody's, got integrity. And that's, both of those things are his mark and trade here. His name is Kedium Awadu, and he is from Los Angeles. He does a broadcast called Lib Radio, and he has been a vocal spokesman in the African-American community in Los Angeles on his webcast, and I recommend everybody go there. He'll give you the details later on in the broadcast. He's going to be with me for the rest of the show. Kedi, are you with me?
Greetings to you, Daryl, and greetings to all of the listeners today. Talking around the world, I guess I should say bonjour, mon frère.
Well, you know, Kedi, is your phone sounds a little rough right now. Is that a...
Well, I'm the best I can. I've got a pretty good phone connection here. Let me just see if I can switch handsets, and we might get a little smoother connection. And if I talk to you, do I talk to you better right now?
Yeah, that's cleaner.
Okay.
Now, you know, what we've going to talk about today is a subject that I guess it's been touched in the periphery in the alternative press, but it really hasn't made any mainstream headlines, and we're going to try to push that out into the mainstream today. It's been out there for years. I've read stuff about it in the past. But it's around Martin King's murder and how this all came to pass. It seems to me there are very powerful flags here, Kedi, that stuff isn't the way it seems. You want to give us an overview of what you've got?
Okay. And first of all, I just want to congratulate you on what you're doing with I Am the Witness. Having looked through your material and listened to your conversations now, I think that your listeners are appreciative, as I am, of the very, very high caliber of credibility that you bring to the research that you do. And we ask that during our conversation that your listeners hold myself to the same high level of integrity of research that you have been presenting to them also.
Well, thank you. And why don't you start out by maybe looking at some of the facts surrounding that the setup for that day and
mm-hmm.
some of the claims that were made as opposed to some of the facts that have been gleaned over time.
Mm-hmm. You had stated a little bit earlier, and I think it's significant, that the mainstream media has been derelict in covering many of the minute details, even some of the great details surrounding the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I think that is very significant, that some of the same media that are now derelict of duty were absolutely detractors and carrying out a character assassination of Dr. King during that time. Some of the distractors that I've mentioned in some of the research that I've published work for people such as the Washington Post, the New York Times, Life Magazine, Time, Newsweek, and Reader's Digest magazines, as well as, you know, widely read columnists, some of whom have now been exposed and were considered at the time, quote-unquote, friends of the Bureau by J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
And now we do know that these media outlets had certain individuals on their staff that were what term is called black propaganda, where they were used as covert outlets for propaganda that was specifically being designed by certain government agencies such as the FBI. And, of course, those of us who have followed this study know that J. Edgar Hoover, or as many of us call him, Gay Edgar Hoover, had a long-standing vendetta and a hatred, a pure hatred of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, so let's talk now about, well, bring us up to speed on the previous assassination attempts or plans to assassinate him that did not come to pass, and then the day that he was killed, and why we're going to bring Mr. Jackson into the conversation quite quickly. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about maybe the Selma March, or even before that. What were some of the other incidents that were kind of lead-ins to this?
Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful book out that I highly recommend, which will serve somewhat as a source of what we're talking about. And the book is by William F. Pepper, Orders to Kill. And in his book, William F. Pepper does talk about that there were two earlier attempts to kill Dr. King. And just as a brief setup before we talk about those, there were a number of people of African-American extraction who were in and around Dr. King or associated with the civil rights movement who in actuality were hostile to Dr. King. These included Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, who was in essence just jealous of Dr. King, and he always asked, well, why do we need one and more than one organization? Persons like A. Philip Randolph, one of the grandfathers of the civil rights movement, again, jealous of this very, very young man, Dr. King, who was getting so much attention. But one person in particular I want to draw attention to, his name is Carl A. Rowan.
Mm-hmm.
Carl A. Rowan was a press columnist, et cetera, and up until recently, I think he died not too long ago, was a fairly prominent syndicated columnist. But during the Lyndon Johnson administration, Rowan was the first African-American appointed to a significant government position with the CIA-affiliated U.S. Information Agency.
Okay.
When we come
that
back,
makes sense. Keedy, we have a break coming up. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we're going to get into that first attempt on Dr. King's life and try to bring it to the day that it happened. And when we come back, more from Keedy Amadu. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back to the great scat sounds of my good friend Giacomo Gates, but we're gonna shift gears and get right back into our conversation with Keedy Awadu right now. Keedy, I want to start back in with that first attempt on his life and how Andrew Young might have been walking with him and some of the things we talked about privately.
That's right. And just a last little second, I'm going to pick up the pace a little bit. This Ty Carl Rowan, who was working with the UN, United States Information Agency, long affiliated with the CIA, it was Carl Rowan who put out the false allegation that Dr. King was under the influence of Maoist communists, therefore allowing Dr. King to be targeted under two U.S. government plots or anti-communist programs called Garden Plot and Cable Splicer. So in actuality, Dr. King was killed illegally because of these machinations. And we were earlier talking about how members of the media were cutouts for these agencies. In 1965, there have been documented that there were two attempts on Dr. King, two attempts to shoot him in March and September of 1965. The first attempt was during the Selma to Montgomery March, and where Dr. King and Andrew Young, as you mentioned, were leading the march of people. We can recall those very famous photographs of them coming across the bridge on that Selma to Montgomery March.
Mm-hmm.
There were at least one and possibly two, no, I think there were definitely two government assassins that were in place that were to get Dr. King and Andrew Young simultaneously as they stepped off of the end of the bridge. But fortunately, I guess, the bodies juxtaposed around and they could not get clear shots, and so the assassins did not fire on those particular days. Later in the year, I believe in September also of 1965, there was another attempt to kill Dr. King where they attempted to, a military, I believe, attempted to draft the service of a Louisville, Kentucky policeman by the name of Clifton Baird, B-A-I-R-D.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Clifton Baird himself who exposed that particular plot.
Let's move forward to the lead up to his being shot in Memphis and what happened around that particular day and how Mr. Jackson figures into this, and give us a little setup on the relationship between Martin King and Jesse Jackson.
Mm-hmm. According to the research that I have published, there were four black ministers who were somehow inadvertently or directly involved in the setup to Dr. King's assassination. There was, of course, the very famous strike that was going on in Memphis with the sanitation workers, if we can recall the photographs of the signs with a sign around their neck, "I am a man." Dr. King was he had traveled to Florida to deliver a speech where he had just received a $200,000 grant from the Ford Foundation, whereupon Dr. King made a speech there in Florida where he said, in essence, that capitalism needs to be reorganized in America. Which, you know, for you to take the beast money in the morning and then condemn the beast in the evening, you know, this is not something that's going to put you in good favor with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was two ministers from Memphis who showed up in Florida to Dr. King's speech and asked him to come to Memphis and to support that strike. What was very interesting is that these two ministers met with Dr. King on a Friday asking him to come, and on Monday a memo shows up in the FBI office saying that Dr. King has confirmed he will be coming to Memphis. And so we might then ask the question whether these two ministers, James Lawton and James Bevel, may have been involved in somehow inadvertently or directly involved in setting Dr. King up for this assassination. Because the details of the assassination were so complex that it apparently took about 1 month to set up all of the assassination details to have Dr. King killed there in Memphis.
So now what we've got also are some there were some difficult relationships going on between Jackson and Martin King, because he felt there was reasons not to trust Jesse Jackson, and you want to enunciate maybe some of those reasons that are maybe general knowledge and some of the things that have come out after the fact.
Yeah, that's a very good point, the way to put that. And we'll start with the general knowledge. For one, there was the very strange behavior of Jesse Jackson. And using the research of a very good friend of mine who's done detailed work, his name is Marcus 3X, Jesse Jackson, the way that this young, brash, bold Jesse Jackson came into the SCLC leadership was based upon activities in Chicago that the SCLC was involved in. And from the very inception, it appears that Dr. King had a great distrust for Jesse Jackson, and those who were close to Dr. King were able to enunciate this at various points. At one point, Dr. King even hired a William Rutherford, a businessman from Chicago, to investigate, to look into Jesse Jackson. Dr. King had said to Rutherford, "The second thing I want you to do is Jesse Jackson so independent. I either want him in the SCLC or out. You go whichever way you want to, but one way or the other, he's part of SCLC or he's not a part of SCLC." And, of course, one of the other tasks that Rutherford was looked into was the activities of the SCLC accountant, a man by the name of Jim Harrison, later exposed to have been an FBI agent who was also manipulating SCLC funds.
Mm.
So now we have the spotlight is being put on Jesse Jackson and a number of other people, including Hosea Williams, Andrew Young, and others, did later confirm that Dr. King had a fundamental distrust of Jesse Jackson.
We'll talk when we come back, we're going to start talking about that day on that balcony and how it all came to pass, ladies and gentlemen. Stick with us. We have a lot more to come with my guest, Kitty Awadu.
Scotch and soda, but in your eye, baby, do I feel high? Oh me, oh my, do I feel high?
And ladies and gentlemen, we are in the middle of a very powerful segment right now, and we're gonna pick it up right now and go right into the day that Martin King was actually shot, and the arrangements that were supposedly made or not made that day to get him out on that balcony. There's a lot of stuff, and maybe you can streamline some of the details of that, Akiti, because it does seem a little bit jumbled in my mind as I read through it all. Because it is full of stuff in there, and there's a lot of contradictions about the story that that Jackson tells about that day and everything. You want to get into that right now?
Right, yeah. Well, let's just set up just briefly the assassination. The assassination appears to have been carried out by the U.S. military intelligence group. There were also, it appears that the gunman who actually fired the fatal shot was hired by a mafioso connection. There was a trial in 1999 where the King family filed a civil suit against Lloyd Jowers, in which Jowers himself confessed his role in hiring the mafia-related assassination gunman who actually fired the fatal shot. But William Pepper's book details how there were two other Army snipers that had Dr. King in their crosshairs but did not fire their bullets that day. There is a document that William F. Pepper reproduces in his book, which is an actual order that goes out on the morning of the assassination. And this order goes out and orders a special operations group from the Army's 111th Military Intelligence Group to go to Memphis to be in place at a certain site at 4:30 a.m. and then to await further orders. And in that particular order, there are several things that are in that particular order. There are several things that are indicative that this not only was a U.S. government assassination, but it literally went up to the highest levels of government, and that it was under three specific programs. There was SYNC Strike, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Strike Command. There was LANTCOM SYNC Special Operations, the Atlantic Command and Eastern Division Military Group, and this was to the chief of the Special Operations. And then there was Operational Planned Guard and Plot, which was a specific wing of SYNC Strike, which dealt with quote-unquote anti-black terrorist operations. And because of the communist tagging of Dr. King, they considered him to be a black terrorist. So the assassination goes down. Some of the things that are very, very indicative. For one, there's a famous photograph of Dr. King laying on a balcony and a man leaning over him. That man's name is Merrill McCullough, who himself, while he was in the a group at the time called the Invaders, which was a black quote unquote street gang from Memphis. He was actually being attached to the Memphis Police Department, where the police chief was a brother of a CIA officer, and later found out that Merrill McCullough himself was at the time a member of the United States Army's 111th Military Intelligence Group.
Well, you know, we've got a top of the hour break for the fake news here, Akiti, and when we come back, we've got a nice long segment coming up. So stick with me. You can go get yourself a cup of coffee or something, ladies and gentlemen. And after the fake news, the French Connection will be right back. We're off the hook. Don't go anywhere.